Of whom? Mr. Cunningham was...
Major Cunningham was an ex... Are you...
Yeah, we're on. Yeah.
Major Cunningham was an ex-World War One officer who was Ford Motor Company's representative and contact man in Washington when it came to taking care of the White House garage and White House cars.
Okay.
So we, I guess we called him on the phone, and he had always been quite friendly, and for a while he'd been in New York, and we knew him. He said, you know, when we put this thing on the blackboard full size, you almost fainted, it was so high. No, he said, Secret Service said, it's got to be that high, and it's got to be that high.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Was it a Lincoln chassis?
Yeah. 160-inch wheelbase.
Right.
So, we built it that high, and my father said, look, they're going to ship it, the body, up to Detroit tomorrow, and don't you put that front nameplate on it either.
Why not? Why not?
Well, it looked so terrible. So I didn't. The funny thing was, in 10 days, the car was back in our plane and said, make another top.
Why?
Lower top.
What happened?
Well, they saw the car, and they saw, you know, they don't know what they're looking at or not. But, so it was sent back, and we spent a staggering sum on that day of $1,500 for a new top structure. And we put it on it, and I put the nameplates on it. And, well, you've seen the pictures here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I drove it out to Delaware Park there to the art gallery to take the picture. And
the Delaware Art Gallery, did you say?
Yeah, it was in Delaware Park.
Delaware Park?
Well, it was Delaware Park, but it was the Albright Art Gallery.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The whole park out there was Delaware Park.
Right. It was about 1935,
36? No, it was a 36 chassis. It must have been late in 36 or 37.
Okay.
And I don't know whether you can... know how the president got into the car, but he got backed up to the car.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to have forward facing auxiliary seats.
Forward
facing.
Oh, forward facing. Yeah.
So he would slide himself, as I have had it described, slide himself onto this forward facing seat, see?
Mm-hmm.
And then he would swing himself around with help and slide himself back onto the,
mm-hmm.
onto the seat. So
out of a wheelchair. Right.
Out of the wheelchair, the boys holding him by the arm.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So
either the Roosevelt boys or the Secret Service boys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way he got in the car.
Yeah, right.
And there was no complaint or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that damn car that was used by FDR, now did he go to Yalta?
He took that to Yalta with him, yeah.
Yeah, he took that to Yalta.
Mm-hmm.
Truman took it to Potsdam.
Right.
And then they bulletproofed it. Somebody else bulletproofed it.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time I saw it in the museum, it looked like one of George Patton's tanks. At the Anzio beachhead or something like that. You know what I mean?
Who had put on the bulletproof canopy?
I don't know.
Was that Truman, do you think, or was that...
Pardon?
Do you think Truman did that, or did Roosevelt have it done?
No, I think the garage had it done. The Secret Service had it done.
Oh, okay, yeah, but what year? In what presidency?
Well, it was that way when it had been retired by the time I got to working in Dearborn there, and it was in the museum, and it was bulletproof at that time.
The war is coming on, the company has been liquidated, your father has died, you've got to move on to other things. What happened? You've just been married, there are not too many years before that.
Yeah, we have Marjorie then.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
this is your career now.
My career now. What I did was, after we got liquidated, I immediately called up George Walker on the telephone in Detroit and said...
George Walker was still with Lincoln?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. He got a job for me up there. He was buying stuff for the bomber.
What year was this? 1940?
42.
You liquidated in 42?
Well,
no.
By the time they got it all buttoned up.
Yeah, okay, fine. The B-24.
I called up George and said, Mr. Walker, I'm looking for a job. And he said, have you got anything up there that I could do till the war is over? And
yeah.
He said, well, just a minute. John Sullivan of the Hudai Hershey Corporation is sitting right beside me.
Can you spell Hudai for us?
Pardon?
Can you spell Hudai?
H-O-U-D-A-I-L-L-E.
And Hershey, Hershey
yeah.
had...
Now, Hudai, Maurice Hudai was a French engineer who designed a recoil mechanism for the French 75s.
Really?
Yeah.
What was its base?
Well, it was called a lever type. It was not a hydraulic shock absorber. It was
spring?
A lever type.
It wasn't even spring.
No, it wasn't even spring. It had a...
Rubber?
No,
no,
it, was made,
rubber.
No, it was made out of steel. It was hydraulic.
Okay, it was hydraulic.
Yeah, there was a cylinder there that was full of oil, and there was a lever that held back the recoil. Well, there was a rich man in Buffalo by the name of Bert Schultz, and he saw the possibility
Schultz?
Of the Schultz, and he saw the possibility.
S-C-H-U-L-T-Z. Right.
He and his backer saw the opportunity of adapting that to the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
And they went over and
which heretofore had been very primitive in its springing head.
That's right.
Yeah.
Hence why we put those Westinghouse things on.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And they went over there and they bought the American rights from the French, or Mr. Hudai, or who, and they came back here and they collared all the shock absorber business in the automobile industry. They became immensely wealthy.
Wow.
And then when the war came along.
What happened to Snubbers?
Rebound Snubbers? I don't know.
That didn't come in yet. Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
Then the war came along and Ford got this B-24 program,
right,
which had a nose wheel.
Ah, yes. Very important.
And this Hudai shimmy damper, as it was called, was just the thing
say
to
that
keep
again?
That thing from shimmying when it landed.
A shimmy damper?
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Because this thing had this wheel running down
right.
in front of the pilot, I think.
Right, yeah.
And if you didn't watch out, it went like this.
Right, yeah. Could cause a dangerous
so the Hudai, Schultz finally sold out for how many $1 million to the Hershey company.
Now, which Hershey company was that?
Not the chocolate company.
Okay, all right.
And they were bumper makers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they got the job to make these shimmy dampers for this
mm-hmm.
B-24 bomber.
Right.
Well, George said, yeah, we can do that if you want to do it now, but the war isn't over yet. And he said, just a minute, John Sullivan from Hudai is sitting right beside me. He was buying those shimmy dampers. And they also made hydraulic landing gear and stuff.
I'm sure they did, yeah.
Well, John says if he's going back tonight, he said if you come in and see him tomorrow, why, he said he'll give you a job. Just like
right.
that.
That's what a fortuitous circumstance.
Yeah, well, you know, they were hiring anybody in those
okay,
days.
Come on. Quite
no, they were.
Anybody who had any experience.
And I went in there and I went into Sullivan. He said, well, the thing, Mr. Brunt, is do you want to go to work?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes, I do. So he pressed a button and turned me over to the guy in charge of the dye making, or gauge making.
Gauge making.
To check precision.
Right.
So I was given a job as a tool designer with a drafting board up there in the tool design department making gauges.
Now where was Hudai at this point?
On Delavan Avenue in Buffalo. And they also...
Delavan?
Yeah, East Delavan Avenue in Buffalo. They also got a big order from Ford on what was known as the Buffalo Arms Company. They were making machine guns.
Oh my gosh.
So, but anyway, I stayed with Hudai there making gauges and things like that for 2 years until the war was tapering off. And then I wrote to Mr. Ford, and this fellow Stevens wrote me and called me back and...
Now, you wrote to Henry Ford II?
Yeah.
And what was the reply again?
Well, the reply came from his secretary, E.C. Stevens, saying that Mr. Ford would be glad to have you come up. He's trying to form a new organization, and he'd like to start right now.
That'd be about 1947, wouldn't it?
No, that was, I came
oh,
up
45.
There in 44.
44, oh my
I mean,
goodness,
I went
yes.
to work there in 44. The family didn't move up there until 45.
That's incredibly early. He was just beginning, wasn't he?
Yeah. And then I got another letter in the next couple of days before I could get up there, a telephone call to go and see Bob Gregory. See?
Tell us a bit about that meeting. Mr. Gregory apparently had been the head of design at Ford for about maybe a decade by then.
Yes, and he was very close, or so he thought, to Mr. Ford.
Yeah, right.
And, I don't want to tell him.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I don't want to tell dirt that I don't know is true.
Oh, just tell what you know.
But he thought, he thought that he and Mr. Ford were like that. And when Mr. Breach came in there, he kind of bypassed Mr. Breach.
Who did?
Gregory.
And wanted to report directly to Henry Ford II?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Henry didn't want it this way, and Breach finally got rid of him that way.
But not before they had the famous competition. Can you fill us in on that for the 49 Ford?
Not before that, no.
Yeah. So,
George Walker was in there with his group working in one studio. And Gregory and the regular gang were working in another studio.
Mm-hmm.
And they picked George Walker's.
Yeah, so that meant Mr. Gregory was invited, in effect, to leave.
Well, he did anyway.
He did. As a matter of fact, as you well know, his design was accepted for the 1948 Mercury, was it not?
No, I didn't know that.
His Ford design. You talked about...
I had a 1948 Mercury.
Well, then it was the first... Well, either that or the 49 Mercury, the 49 Mercury.
Yeah.
I had
a 50, too.
You talked about Mr. Talberg. Did you know Mr. Joe Galam?
Well, no, not very well. I had Good Morning Mr. Galam arranged, but that's all. I knew who he was and knew all about him.
He was another excitable, somewhat imperious...
Is that so?
Central European.
He's an old timer there.
Yeah, he's been there for a long time. What kind of job were you assigned to?
I was assigned to working with Martin Rakitko on full size layout.
Your old friend from Buffalo.
No, Rakitko from Utica, from Willoughby.
Oh, he'd been at Willoughby. He'd never worked for Brown, huh?
No.
Oh, he'd always worked for Willoughby. Okay.
And then Victor came up, and he was working with Martin. Martin was the boss, whatever you want to call it, supervisor of that surface layout department.
Okay, and that was in the old
old
engineering building,
library, yeah.
Now called Triple E.
And then
who else was in
then,
that group with you?
Then there was a young fellow that had come in for General Motors by the name of Ted Hobbs. You remember him?
I've heard of him. What about him?
Well, Ted Hobbs had worked for Custom Body for Holbrook and some other custom body builder down in New York, and he and I became great friends, and he had come from General Motors and been put in charge of interior trim and exterior color.
HOBBS?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked Gregory if he couldn't have me over to help him, and Gregory said, why, sure, and I said, yeah, I'd love to do it rather than laying out on this drawing board.
Right, yeah.
So that was the beginning. Ted and I were great friends. We both belonged to the Pine Lake Country Club and played golf every Saturday.
Where was Pine Lake?
On Orchard Lake, or on Pine Lake, near Orchard Lake, Pontiac.
Okay, right.
And then all
well,
of a sudden...
Well, no, excuse me. You went from layout work on the drawing board to interior trim work? What sort of discipline was that?
Well, this is developing fabrics and exterior colors and things like that.
Well, good. Now, this opened up a whole new area for you.
Yeah, this is more fun.
Yeah, a lot more fun, yeah.
So, then...
What?
Lincoln Mercury, Dick Crappy, remember him?
Yeah.
vice president of the Mercury Division.
Right.
Dick Craffey and the Lincoln Division and so forth began to want to have some fellows just working on their interior alone and their colors alone and not be mixed up with the Ford.
Okay.
So I was chosen to take the Lincoln Mercury job.
Who chose you?
I don't know, Charlie Waterhouse was a big boss then.
We don't know that. Tell us about Charlie Waterhouse. What was he sort of an overall design?
This was before there was a styling office. This was when we were part of body engineering.
The early 50s.
Yeah, Charlie had come there from General Motors in the General Motors exodus when Grebe and those guys had come there.
Yeah.
And I was given this job and went on from there, and then...
Well, how did it work? We got lots of time. Give us some details on how...
Well, I worked with the textile developers and picked out samples that I liked and other people liked on my staff, and we would put them up on racks and easels and show them to the divisional management, and those that they looked upon favorably, we had samples made up in seat trim, seats, upholstery, seats upholstered and
bucks,
trim bucks and things,
bucks.
And we went on when the fabric was selected. We went on and matched them to the proper colors, but I liked it because I got a lot of traveling down to the textile mills and all this stuff. Yeah.
Oh, they didn't come to you. You had to go to them.
Well, they came to us, but I'd go down there and
down in the Carolinas and
Georgia.
You'd pick out the best of the fabrics that they were offering you.
That I thought, yeah. We had a lot of sources in those days.
Oh, yes. What was the preferred fabric in the early 50s?
Well, you see, when I first got there, they were still working with wool, and then I was right there at the right time when they were beginning to bring synthetics in, like nylon and rayon and other decorative fabrics. The thing that thrilled me the most was Lurex. That was a metallic.
L-U-R-E-X?
L-U-R-E-X.
That was a metallic thread?
It was a metallic thread with various widths, which dialed up. I said it was the happiest thing that ever happened to the textile industry, and Dorothy Leavies, who was their...
Who's that?
Designer, Dorothy Leavies, who was a designer and promoter of this stuff, she was so happy. I said that was the happiest thing that ever happened to the textile business.
Can you spell her name? Remember off then?
L-I-E-B-E-S.
She worked for the industry?
Yeah, she was a consultant for the textile industry. Okay. She was, hired by Collins and Aikman and J.P. Stevens and Chatham and those other textile people.
Collins? And Aikman?
Collins and Aikman. They're still one of our suppliers.
How do you spell the last name?
A-I-K-M-A-N.
And for C-O-L-L-I-N-S. This lady, tell us about Lurex. What was its composition? How was it put together? Do you remember offhand?
Well, it was a laminated
Synthetic
yarn.
Yeah.
You could get it in gold, or you could get it in silver, and later on then they began to bring it around in colors, in greens and reds, and this was, at that time, it was already being used in the garment industry, and women's wear.
Oh, really?
But the greens and the reds, they were all right on dresses and things like that, but they didn't look too appropriate in an automobile, so...
How did they achieve the metallic sheen?
It was a foil.
It was a foil?
Yeah.
Really? Did it ever unwrap or
No.
It was impregnated into the...
Yeah.
So it was gold foil.
It was the yarn itself.
Okay.
Now listen, Lurex had no strength.
Oh.
Did nothing to hold the fabric together.
On its own.
Just decorative.
Simply decorative. Yeah. Okay. But
it was used as a filling. The filling yarn is the yarn that runs crosswise in the seat.
I see. I mean,
the warp runs this way.
Uh-huh.
And this was used as a filling, and it would go under, and then it would come out down here, and it would come out down here and raised up the happiness of the interior.
It certainly did give it a sheen and a brilliance that it never had before.
No, you could overdo it too. I mean, just because little is good, more doesn't mean more is better. All
that. Yeah, right. What about Naugahyde? Did that come in yet?
Well, Naugahyde was nothing but more than a vinyl coated material. Naugahyde was a trade name put on it by U.S. Rubber.
I see. Now, vinyls were coming into their own just about this time.
Vinyls, yeah, vinyls were just
coming. Vinyl, you had rayon, you had nylon, yeah. and you had this metallic thread. This must have been a very great
wool story. And genuine leather were gradually going out. See.
But you could still get leather if you wanted
it. Yes, you can. I guess you get it.
I mean, even those days.
Get it in the Lincoln and the Cadillac. And
but wool pretty much phased out, wasn't it? It didn't last.
Yeah, I don't know. There's no wool anymore. You know, it's great. I can
you
tell
get synthetic cloth now, don't you?
I can tell by looking at them.
Yeah. What?
But I mean, even the headlining that used to be made out of wool faced cotton. The headlining's like in my car down there is a bunch of little pieces of cloth all chopped up and sprayed on there on a board and then snapped in there.
This is your tempo?
Hmm?
Your tempo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same on Margie's Chevy, whatever she calls it, Celebrity or something.
Celebrity, same thing. Yeah. Do you view this as is this a good technique or is it schlock?
No, it's a good technique. It makes a good looking job.
Uh-huh.
And my God, it's cheaper than when the guys used to have to go around there tacking them in, you know?
Okay. They last, reasonably.
Yeah. What it's on is sprayed on a foundation board, like a piece of shirt cardboard or something.
Oh, I see.
Only it fits in under the rails around there, and I believe must have some adhesive on the inside because they don't tack it in or do it anything. They just put it in up there and tack it in and pass their hands over and it's all done, see?
What material is it again?
Pardon?
What is the material?
You mean the...
The headliner. What is it made of?
The surface?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, some synthetic fabric that's all chopped up into a powder.
That looks like wool or something?
It looks like wool, if you want to say that.
That's incredible. But it lasts, though.
And it was cemented onto a piece of flexible board of some kind. They sprayed it on. I've seen this done before. I quit even. And then it was all over, dried on there fast, and all they did was bend the board that was on and fit it under the rails around the side and under the windshield, and you couldn't get it out. It stayed there.
Naive me, I thought that was still cloth up there sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, back to the 50s. As I recall from coming through it and looking at material since then, there was an explosion of colors at Ford at this point.
When?
Explosion of colors. There were two tones. There were treble tones. There were the Crestliner that stole your old scallop from the 20s on the side, but you were doing the color coordinating with interior upholstery to the outside. How'd that work? How'd that liaison work between interior and exterior trim?
Well, I had to use your eyes. I mean, that's why I don't think they trust the human eye anymore.
They don't. You were the last of the visual experts to.
Probably.
To work
I don't know. They had the fellow I saw his name on Dick Chappell. You never know Dick Chappell?
Yeah.
Well, he worked for me, and I got a notice the other day you retired.
I suppose last name?
Chappell.
Mm-hmm.
And.
Was he a color man or an interior man?
Well, he was a fabric man.
Fabric man?
He worked for me as long as I was there, and. I was down in Rancho Bernardo when Marty sent the invitation to the party down, so I couldn't get down anyway.
Oh, yeah.
But I wrote him a letter.
Where was it? Somewhere here in California?
No, in Detroit.
Oh, way back in Detroit. Oh,
a place I never heard of.
Yeah, you don't remember the name.
And he's gone now, and everybody else is gone. And so I got no place, nobody to go to when I need to find out why I don't get my John Hancock forms to send to the dentist or something like that.
Oh, Dick, I see.
Dick, they're a mess. They made an awful mess out of that.
Have they? But this was many years in the future. We're still back in the early 50s. So, so you've, for the purposes of your career interview, you've become an interior color coordinator in terms
of and developer of exterior paint.
Tell us a little bit about that. You didn't mention that before.
Well,
how did that work out?
Worked with the paint manufacturer. See, we had our own paint plants, you know.
Right, I remember that. Where was that located? Right there in the
room? Well, first it was at Highland Park.
Yeah.
And then they built a plant out at Utica.
Utica, that's the one I remember. Yeah.
Now they've just sold the whole thing to DuPont.
Oh, and they're buying their paints from DuPont?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Because when I was there, all the pressure was on. Now, look, we got to get 85% of our paint from out of our own paint plant.
We don't want to buy from GM. Or
no, this is buying it from GM, really, you know.
Yeah, right.
But there were other good paint people, which we got paint from, like Richard Mason and Gessler and these places. But
Richard Mason had a big plant in Detroit during the early 40s.
That was right near the Lincoln plant.
Right next to the Lincoln plant. You see it in all the photographs.
I've been there a lot of times.
Yeah.
And I just read recently in the Automotive News that they had sold the paint plant to DuPont, and that the same people were going to be hired, only they were going to be same plant. They're going to be working for DuPont instead of Ford. But I don't quite know how they got away with it or how they did it, because when I was there, we were making our own paint, 80% or 85%.
Yeah.
This discouraged outside suppliers from showing us new developments in paints, because they knew they might get a year's production out of it, but if it ran on for another year, why, it would all go over to Utica, see?
Oh, I see, okay.
So, what are they gonna do now? And this also caused DuPont to show their best developed colors to General Motors.
Of course.
Now, when they opened that tech center out there, the Society of Automotive Engineers invited them out there to see the place and have dinner. And
this was GM.
Then they took us on a...
General Motors, 1954.
Out of Troy, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Took us on a tour of the place, and it kept you in an aisle and ropes on either side, but as we came through the German color department, there was a fellow by the name of Jay Snyder there that I knew pretty well and worked there, and he said, wait a minute. He came over and he lifted up the rope and he took me in behind and showed it to me. General Motors had built this big circular room with paint chips and rods till hell wouldn't have it, you know. And you could spin that around if you were looking for blues. You'd spin that around until the blues came up and you'd look for the right blues. Or if you were looking for greens, you'd spin that around.
Mm-hmm.
That was because that was their biggest customer.
Sure.
At one time, DuPont was their biggest stockholder.
Right.
Listen, I think I better go and see where Gus is.
Yeah. You were telling us that you were also the exterior color consultant.
Yes, that's right.
Coordinator for
the developer.
Now tell us a little bit about that.
We worked with the
paint companies.
With the paint companies, Rich and Mason and Ditzler and some with DuPont, but not
was
too
that
much.
Duco? They called it Duco in those days?
They called it Duco, or Duco Lax.
Duco Lax was the earlier one, yeah. Duco Lax, yeah, right, yeah. What did Lax mean? What did that mean?
I don't know.
So this was in the...
General Motors. See, I haven't been working for 16 years, but
that's true.
General Motors always used peroxylene.
Did they?
Which required a polishing.
Mm-hmm.
Ford Motor Company, back in the, going way back to the soybean days,
right,
used lacquer,
right,
which required no polishing, but did show some orange peel.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by orange peel?
A little.
Pebbly? A little pebble or?
Well, you know what the skin of an orange looks like, almost black marks kind of like.
A little pebble effect, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pockmark.
So that we call, that's what we call, orange peel.
Well, that's really a pockmark rather than a pebble, isn't it? It's an indentation.
It's more like a skin, right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, why did that happen?
Well, that's because the General Motors, they polished that off.
Yeah.
Now, as long as you, when you had a car and as long as you could have black, well, they didn't care whether it had.
You were saying that you couldn't have the orange peel effect for what reason?
Well, when you were competing with this beautiful General Motors stuff on the Cadillacs,
right,
you couldn't have orange peel showing on your Lincolns.
Right. So what'd you do?
Well, they got some very fine chemists. They hired a fellow from DuPont even and paid him a lot of money, and they had a fellow, I think he's still there, by the name of Johnny Young, that did a lot of, was a chemist and did a lot of work on that stuff. He did a lot of work in pollution control out here in California, or they wouldn't have been able to build cars at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In terms of paint?
No, in terms of environmental pollution.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay.
You know, they got real strict rules about
mm-hmm.
California, especially around Los Angeles. I mean, you've seen smog down there, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've seen that. You were happy doing this? Did you find it a rewarding rewarding existence?
Yeah. You met a lot of nice outside people, interesting outside people.
Interesting people. You got away from the plant and away from the shop. Uh-huh. So how long did that go on, that particular segment of your Ford career? How long did
went on. See, I was given the job of manager of the trim and color development material.
Were you really? Who did you report to in those days?
Well, I reported to, when Ted Hobbs was still there, reported to him, and then after that, I reported to Jim Sipple.
Jim Sipple? Mm-hmm. S-I-P-P-L-E?
Yeah, you know Jim?
I heard of him. I haven't met him yet.
He's retired now.
What was his responsibility in those days?
Pardon?
What was his responsibility?
Well, he was a chief manager of all interior operations.
Okay, right. Mm-hmm.
Not only materials, but design and so on.
Right, mm-hmm, right.
And, I think he was. See, Jim had been sent to Germany twice. Jim had been in Germany one time, and then he came back when Hobbs retired, and they gave the job to Hobbs, did it to me.
Mm-hmm.
This is when Damon Woods was running the thing. And then Jim was put on the charge of the truck studio.
Uh-huh.
This was after I had left. Jim was the last fellow I worked for, really.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But when I retired, I wrote a little note to Mr. Ford, addressed it to him, and said that it reminded him of my coming up there in 1944, and that in spite of the aggravations and problems that arise in creative work, it had been both a pleasant and profitable stay, and I would always remain a loyal Ford customer.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a nice little letter from him.
Mm-hmm. Thanking you for your
That was the end of that.
But now, you don't want to end it there. What happened between 1956 and 1970? You got 15 years there, right?
Well, I was working on trim and color.
But what sort of existence was it? How did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed it very much.
Did you have any interaction with your opposite numbers at the other companies? Who would those have been?
Oh, yes, like a General Motors? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Yeah, who would that have been?
Well, Henry Love. I don't know if you
heard of Henry Love, L-A-U-V-E.
Henry Love, Henry Dessour Love.
Yes, tell us about him.
He was a Frenchman.
Was he?
Uh-huh. You know, very great artist.
Mm-hmm.
Fine arts artist, too. And I used to, we used to see him at parties and things, and
mm-hmm.
other people whose names I've forgotten.
You know Ted Moon? Did you know him?
I met him, yes. I don't know, who was the head of the styling now? That's
Irv Rybicki.
Rybicki, is he?
He's about ready to retire, I think in September.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
He got the bald headed guy's job at all, who gets face gets purple when he drinks. You know what I mean?
Bill
Mitchell.
Bill Mitchell. Yes.
Did you ever see him get pink?
Yes, no, I've never seen him.
You never saw him get blue?
No. Well, tell us about some of the people at Ford. What about Jean Bordenay? Did you have a good relationship?
Oh, yes.
What was your impression of him?
Well, I thought he knew his job. Another one I think that knows his job is Don Kapka.
Awfully good man, yeah.
Awfully good man, and I predicted that when I left there, that when Gene retired, he would get the job. Now, I don't quite understand what the organization is there. He seems to be vice president in charge of styling, but Jack Telnick, whom I only met on the telephone between Detroit and Australia.
Really?
Yeah, I used to talk to him quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think I've seen him once since he's back over here. He seems to be in charge of North American operations.
North American Design, NAD.
And what's Don?
He's vice president in charge of all styling. Of design. Vice president in charge of design. But his operations seem to be concerned with the future rather than the present.
I see. Yeah. Well, I like both of those fellows. As I say, I saw Tom like once, and the other times I knew him quite well. I talked to him on the telephone a couple times a week.
Uh-huh. John Najjar was a friend of yours, was he not?
He was what?
John Najjar was a friend of yours.
Oh, my goodness. He was there when I came there.
Right. He and Ray Gitko.
He came there in 38, I think.
Mm-hmm. Those were fun days back in the old... South end of the
engineering
laboratory. You and John and Red Gitko, and who else was there in those days?
Oh, Victor was there. Victor Lang was there, and there was a guy by the name of German by the name of Paul Gonsenhuber.
Gonsenhuber?
Gonsenhuber.
How do you spell his name?
Well, Gons is a goose. But I don't know what the Huber means.
G-A-N-Z-E-R?
No, Gans. G-A-N-S-E-N. Or G-A-N.
S-S-E-N?
S-S-E-N is a Gonson. A Gans is a goose. And
Huber? H-U-B-E-R.
I don't know what that
was. What did he do?
Well, he was a surface layout.
Do you remember Benny Barbero?
Oh, yes.
Benny's still working for the company.
He is?
Yes, he refuses to retire.
He must be 100 years old.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. What was he, a clay modeler?
Yeah, he was in the fabrication and clay modeling. Yeah. Yeah, right, yeah. You say when you came, later on after Gregory left, Mr. Waterhouse came in as the overall supervisor? Remember Charlie Waterhouse?
Oh, yeah, sure.
He's still alive. Can you imagine that?
I'm trying to think, though. You see, Tom Hibbard was assistant to Gregory.
Mm-hmm. Then Tom became...
No, he didn't. Tom left and went down to... what's the outfit down on Livernois in Michigan, I think it is, that makes the... Wheels.
Chelsea Hayes.
Chelsea Hayes.
Right.
He went down there and finished out his retirement there, his working life there, and retired back up to dear old Maine.
Oh, that's where Tom was from, yeah.
He died recently, or died last year, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Too bad. I keep coming back to Bourdonnais. Bourdonnais worked his way up by dint of his, the force of his personality, into a vice presidency.
Great salesman, too.
Great salesman, yeah. Was he much of a designer that you could
tell? Yes, he was a good designer, and a good salesman.
Yeah.
And I liked him. He and I got along very well. When I was first given that Lincoln Mercury job on trim and color, he was the chief designer of the whole Lincoln Mercury operation, and I was awfully glad that I got put with him rather than somebody else.
Yeah, right. But what about Al Mueller? Do you remember him?
Oh, yes.
Did he come up under you?
Al Mueller, now wait a minute. Al Mueller was the head of the... Wait a minute, this is where I was wrong. Jim Simple was not the last one. Al Mueller was the last one.
Ah, okay. He was head of the interior when you left. Some of the others who signed your retirement poster, the man who's currently one of the interior men, interior chiefs.
Tom Bauer?
Gail Hollerman.
Is he still there?
Still there, yes, right.
Well, he was a younger fellow.
Do you remember Gail much?
Oh, yes, very much.
A good man, was he?
Yeah, very nice.
Don Kopka, you said. Don Kopka was, at that time, probably, what was he in the when you retired?
Well, he came from Chrysler, you know.
Right, yeah.
And I picked him as a comer.
Did you? Uh-huh. Certainly he's done well. Jim Sipple, what was he again?
He's retired, living in Florida.
What was his job when you were working with him?
He was the head of the interior operations.
He was also an interior, yeah. Who, of all the people you worked with in those days, what person, of all the people you worked with, continuing the question, who was the most inspirational to you? In your latter-day career?
Well, Ted Hobbs.
Ted Hobbs, uh-huh.
It was just like my father. He had the same ideas about styling and
uh-huh.
designing of automobiles. Of course, he came from the custom body era, I see.
Who did he work for?
Well, he worked for old Brooke Brewster.
Uh-huh.
One of the Brewster boys got mad at his brothers, and one of the Holbrook boys got mad at their mother, so they formed a company called Holbrook Brewster. Yeah, down in New York, and Ted worked for them, and then he worked for another company up in Boston for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was one of the first seven men that Harley Earl hired when he opened his
Ted
art and color department.
Ted Hobbs was?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How long did he stay with Harley Earl?
Till the war.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing to do, of course, there, and they gave him a job as a steel expediter.
Oh, dear. Typical.
And, well, it was a job, you know,
sure.
He had to do
yeah.
it.
Right.
And then, as the war closed, he somehow or other came over to Ford.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I met him.
Mm-hmm. What do you think brought him over? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. He never told me, so they just came over, whether Gregory came over or brought him over, or I don't know who brought him over, or whether he just decided he didn't want any more. I mean, General Motors with Harley Earl and those guys was a tough place to work.
Sure.
So I'm told, as I hear from Ted and other fellas.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, so Ted Hobbs was an inspiration to you and a marvelous person to work for.
Yes.
And he appreciated your...
Real good partners. I said he belonged to Pine Lake, joined after I did, and
right.
we used to have a lot of great times on the golf course, and so the poor fellow came down with what the hell was it that he got before he got What's blood cancer?
Leukemia?
Leukemia.
Yeah, nothing you can do about it.
That's what he died of.
And you
he'd
were...
be, he'd be getting... Go to the hospital, the Ford Hospital, and they'd give him transfusions, and he'd be all right for a week or so, but then he'd be right back in there and have to have another transfusion, see? Mm-hmm.
When did he die, or when did he retire?
He didn't retire. He retired, yes, and then he died a couple of weeks later.
He literally worked until he...
Yeah, this is what I thought was kind of silly, because he said, no, it's just in my pride, I'm going to stick it out till I'm 65. Well, this settled me that I was going to retire at 62 while I was young.
That's what you did, huh?
Yeah, while I was young and fairly healthy and we could have fun, which we did.
Mm-hmm.
And my father had a saying, you always want to do the things you want to do now because you're going to be dead a long time. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah, and you've never regretted that?
No,
that
I've never regretted that.
So you retired in 1970, and in March of 1970, and that's been how many years ago now? That's 16 years. Yeah, just 16 years, just beyond 16 years. Have you been doing any in retirement? Did you do any work, any consulting work of any kind in color?
Well, with these fellows, not in colors, but with these fellows on a restoration.
Yeah.
Cars, my archives are invaluable, and
well, tell us about your work with Hillsboro and Pebble Beach. That would be of interest, I think.
Well, we go around and
tell us a little bit about
where one of the, what?
Tell us a little bit about Hillsboro, what it is. Well, Pebble Beach first, and then
well,
Hillsboro.
Pebble Beach and Hillsboro are the same type of thing. Only Hillsboro is, or Pebble Beach is much bigger
and much older.
Oh yes, 35,
yeah.
40 years old.
Yeah. Who started the Pebble Beach Concours d'Elegance? That's in California, isn't it?
Yeah, at Carmel.
Carmel, yes.
Who started that? I don't know who started it, but it's run by Jules Heumann.
How do you spell his last name?
H-E-U-M-A-N.
Uh-huh.
And another fellow that's also, this fellow Heumann is an amazing man on the history of Bugatti, Bugattis and Hispano Suizas. You know, he's got a list of every damn Hispano Suiza that was ever made.
Does he really? That's
yeah.
Incredible. Keep talking, please. Yeah. We'll get that on the tape. That's right.
What?
We'll get that television on the tape. That's right. Close.
Oh.
Yeah. When was this? What year was it started? Pebble Beach. What year was it founded? You said 35 years it's been going?
35 or 40 years. They skipped 1 year. It was long before I came out here.
And this has, where is this held, the Concours?
Held at the Lodge at Pebble Beach.
Which is a golf course? Or
yes.
Famous golf course?
Famous golf course where the Bing Crosby tournaments have been held and national opens. And
mm-hmm.
It's on 17 Mile Drive. Which is a very exclusive drive through the woods there, and they have a lot of this girl, she's not a girl anymore, but, Carol Rissell.
Rissell?
Yeah, she...
How do you spell her last name?
R-I-S-S-E-L.
Uh-huh.
She's the head of special events down there, like golf tournaments and this kind of stuff.
For Pebble Beach,
which is owned by... used to be owned by Del Monte, but it's now owned by 20th Century Fox.
Ah, okay. Now, describe a typical Concours d'Elegance at Pebble Beach. How would it...
Well, these cars are all placed out.
Are these by invitation only?
Yes.
In other words, the board of directors or the chief judges or whoever runs the Concours would send out
invitations.
Yeah. Now, what sort of group? What kind of people would they invite? The top restored owners of restored cars.
Yeah. Just a minute, I got to see what that was.
So the invitation would go out to whom? What type of people?
Well. Those that have the best cars and have had the best cars in the past. What they try to do is get new cars, new restored cars that,
mm-hmm. that haven't been shown before.
Each year that haven't been shown before.
Mm-hmm.
And like this year, it's the 110th anniversary, as you know, of Mercedes.
Ah, so that'll be the theme this year.
That'll be the theme this year. Last year it was Bugatti.
Bugatti, okay. Uh-huh.
And I was unable to go last year on account of Augustus' hip.
Oh dear, that must have been a disappointment to you.
Yes, but I couldn't go down.
No.
And I slept on a rollaway bed in her bedroom there for 8 weeks.
Terrible.
Well, it wasn't terrible for me. It was terrible for her.
Yeah, right? Yeah, she was in great pain, wasn't she?
Well, she really wasn't in pain, but I mean, I didn't dare let her get up to go to the bathroom or do anything like that, see?
No.
No, she said, she still said she hadn't, a lot of people say, well, they were in great pain. Well, no, she was in pain. The only time she was in pain was when the ladies and I put her into the car.
Right.
And she got in a position where it didn't hurt, and then I drove as fast as I could down to this hospital.
Mills Hospital, yeah. Are there different categories of judging in the Concours de l'Elegance?
Yes.
What would be the categories?
Well, there are some.
Take the last year that you did the judging before Bugatti. What was that?
Well, they're classified into like open cars and convertibles and closed cars.
As by model.
Now like we have three of us. They work on elegant open cars,
mm-hmm.
which includes convertibles.
Right.
Elegant closed cars. Don't get me started, because I claim an elegant car is a conservative car.
Okay.
Not a
that's
red one like that.
Yeah, right.
Beautiful, but not a red one.
Mm-hmm.
And they have field judges,
uh-huh.
six or eight guys that are going around and looking for accuracy.
Right.
And then we are the guys, like God, that just go around and see which one we think is the most elegant thing.
But in a Concours, they're paraded in front of you, aren't they?
Well, this comes later.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, yeah.
They sit out there on the field, and they're examined by the judges, and then they're run over that ramp, and the announcer tells, there's a minister down there,
Oh, Mr. Paul Woodenberg.
You know Paul Woodenberg?
Yes, I met him, yes. Uh-huh.
He's not as good as this fellow was.
Isn't he?
Uh-huh. Don't tell him I said
no, I won't. I don't
have to see him. And they announce the car and what award has been given them, and then they finally, when they get done, why the honorary judges go off and they decide the best in the show.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Which generally is about 4:00. Now they're going to start the judges. They want the judges down for breakfast at 7:30.
Good heaven.
This year. Because, and they won't open the gates until 10, because this keeps the crowd out.
Mm-hmm.
So the judges get a better crack at it, see?
Yes, right. Well, you enjoy it very much.
Yes, I enjoy it very much, and I see people I haven't seen, like Peterson. I see him there every year, and we talk.
John Peterson, chairman of the Ford Motor Company.
John Peterson, I talk to him about Chase Morsey and all these guys. And
where's Mr. Morsey again?
Well, he had gone with RCA, but he is now retired and lives in Scottsdale, Arizona.
What do you do when you have a Brun automobile?
Well, unfortunately, we haven't had a hell of a lot of Bruns, but I would disqualify myself, I think.
Would you normally? Yeah. You told me once that there's someone in California who has about a couple of dozen Bruns that he's collected.
Well, this might be Jack Passy, it might be Tom Powell. Is there a Lincoln Hounds? There's one Touring Cabriolet that's owned by Walt Shear down in Thousand Oaks. And there is Matthew Browning of the Browning Firearms Company that has a exhibition hall of his own up in Ogden, Utah, and he lives in Ogden, Utah in the winter, summertime, and down at Borrego Springs in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And Well, I'll tell you this, I just stole him $15,000 worth of non-Brun archives.
Did you?
Yeah, for this museum up there.
Which, what museum is that?
Well, this is the Browning Museum. Now, he's got the shop that his grandfather first founded, the Browning Firearms Company.
Right.
And then he's got the railroad station that's up there that he's taken over as an automobile museum.
And where is that located?
In Ogden, Utah.
Ogden, Utah. Not far from
Mrs. Browning is just as rabid as he is, if not more so.
Not far from Promontory Point, where Union Pacific and Northern Pacific.
Yes, I guess it's too.
Yeah, right.
And then another very active fellow is Otis Chandler. He's collecting cars by the bagful. I mean, like sending Harry Andrews over there and bringing them back on a Concorde, chartering the Concorde to bring it back, you know.
This is of the Chandler Publishing Company, the Los Angeles Times, and others.
It's the Times Mirror Company.
Mirror Company, right, yeah. And is he the oldest Chandler at the moment, or is he a younger Chandler?
Well, I'd say he's about 60.
Oh, I see.
His daughter just got married. One of the daughters just got married the other day. And
is he still active in publishing?
Well, he is not active in the management of the Times. He was chief executive officer and chairman of the board of the Times Mirror Corporation,
which is the Chandler family,
which publishes the Times. And I have never seen the Mirror, but it sounds like a tabloid to me.
Yeah,
and other magazines of various types they publish. Yeah. I don't know what they are.
Yeah. Well, Hillsborough is sort of a junior edition of Pebble Beach.
That's right. Now there's a big pavilion down there known as the Chandler Pavilion that his mother donated.
Oh, yes.
You know that? That's where they have the... That's where they have the Oscar presentations
right.
every year and things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Yeah, right. Is he angling for some sort of a classic car show there? Does he want to... use that as a
I don't think
show
so.
Place.
That's just a show place. Oh, that Chandler Pavilion? No,
yeah.
He's got a garage of his own that's kind of a show place down there, too.
Mm-hmm.
No, but this is
a
garage.
It's private. It's not open to the public. Yeah. Hillsborough, how long has that been in existence?
Well, that's been going some 30 years, I was surprised.
Has it really?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It was sort of a counterpart, but in the Bay Area.
Well, up until 2 years ago, it was run by the Sports Car Club.
Oh, it was.
And then they decided, like with the coming of the candy store over here, that the...
Candy store in Burlingame.
In Burlingame, that they will make more effort to have unique, high-class automobiles, and they certainly succeeded this last time.
Yeah, the last time, yeah. The French classic car was marvelous.
Well, there's a Frenchman by the name of Jacques Harding guy got a whole bunch of, what the hell, Lamborghinis, a couple of Lamborghinis and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And this fella made his money washing windows.
Good heavens.
He's a Basque.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't get him after 12 o'clock at noon because he and the staff clean many, many of the buildings, business buildings in San Francisco. That's all I know. Not all of them, I suppose, but
yeah.
Washing the windows and mopping the floors.
He
chartered a Concorde too for a Maybach Zeppelin, you know, to bring over.
Oh my gosh. Well, in the last few minutes we have on our last tape, Mr. Brun, can you sort of sum up your career in three or four sentences? And
well, I can sum up my career as being a very pleasant one.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very fortunate to be the son of Herman A. Brun.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also very fortunate that I had a father that took me around with me when I was in my teens, some in early 20s. And I became acquainted with so many of these people
mm-hmm.
that were prominent in the automobile industry.
Uh-huh. And you absorbed all the atmosphere of the shop and the design areas.
Yes,
and
then this experience in Paris was priceless.
Oh, it must have been, yeah.
Not only from an artistic automobile standpoint, but from, you know, the country, great people, I mean.
Marvelous taste.
Marvelous taste, yes. Yeah. Like,
a couple of words, in a couple of words, what, how do you sum up car design as you have appreciated it over the years? Maybe two words. Good car design.
Well,
quickly now.
I think design, people's theories on design change with the ages, change
right.
with the period.
Well, two words, quickly.
Well, I think it's improved.
Right.
I don't like them all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's improved as compared with
that's
well,
right.
this one of Mrs. Carter's, and I showed you, stuff
yeah.
like that.
Compared with the 1920s?
Oh, yes.
Yes. How is it today?
It's improved. I mean, the design and the overall design, the silhouette and the pictures, but I'll tell you, there's one thing I don't like.
What? Great.
There's no room for the passenger in the back. Always used to have a story that give the passenger in the back leg room because he likes to get in the car and take all his anatomy with him.
Right.
And out of this car,